Hi, Dave Emery here. This is side one, for the record, program number 782, titled All's Well That's Orwell, part two, The Ministry of Truth and the Ukrainian Crisis, part two, subtitled Shmeiman Uber Alles. This has been recorded on March 16th of the year 2014. We're going to take up once again our coverage of what is going on in the Ukraine, and in this case, not only what is going on in the Ukraine, but the coverage, the nature of American journalistic coverage of what is going on in the Ukraine. In the description for this show, and there are always article length, rigorously annotated and excerpted descriptions for each For the Record program in the For the Record category on the front page of the SpitfireList.com website. And I will link to an article and excerpt some text from a relatively famous Rolling Stone magazine article from September of 1977. It was authored by Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame, Watergate coverage fame, and it is about the CIA's role with major American media, and in particular the New York Times, or the Gray Lady, as it is known. The New York Times is by far and away America's best daily newspaper. It is also, however, the CIA's number one propaganda asset. It was the New York Times, for example, that published the untenable Warren Report and continues to defend it to this day. Again, the Times is our best paper and worth reading, but boy, oh boy, do you have to handicap it. It's like playing baseball. When you step up to the plate with the New York Times on the mound, you want to make very sure which way the ball is curving and which way it's going to break, because otherwise they will pitch you a curve and you will go down swinging, and that has happened a great deal. In For the Record 781, we took a look at large excerpts of a chapter from a book titled The Return, the book actually was titled Analyzing Fascist Discourse, European Fascism in Talk and Text. It was edited by Ruth Wodak, W-O-D-A-K, and John E. Richardson, published by Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E, in 2013. And there was a very valuable chapter in that book by Professor Per, P-E-R Anders, A-N-D-E-R-S, Rudling, R-U-D-L-I-N-G, of Lund University in Sweden. That's spelled L-U-N-D. That chapter is titled The Return of the Ukrainian Far Right, The Case of V.O. Svoboda. And it is about the Svoboda Party. That is a Ukrainian fascist political party that is a direct heir to the OUNB of Stefan Bandera, a Third Reich ally. Svoboda is very explicit about being a descendant of and an ideological compatriot of the Banderites. And Svoboda is explicitly fascist and extremist, although they go to considerable length to make themselves out to be more mainstream and more moderate. In fact, as we looked at in the program last week, it will be difficult to exaggerate how fascistic, how bigoted, and how extreme Svoboda really is. They glorify street fighting. They are doctrinaire. Doctrinaire anti-Semites and anti-Russians, but also anti-Pole, anti-Asiatic, as they call them, and anti just about everybody. And their top ideologist, the ideological mentor for Oleg Tyanovuk, the leader of the party, is a guy named Mikhail Shishin. And Mikhail Shishin is about as right as it gets. He couldn't be called a Holocaust denier or Holocaust revisionist. He is a Holocaust celebrant. He thinks it was one of the best things that ever happened and that it should be repeated. When Viktor Yushchenko came to power in the Ukraine as a result of the so-called Orange Revolution, we have looked at the fact that his wife was a woman named the former Ekaterina Chumachenko. She had been not only Ronald Reagan's deputy director of public liaison, but also had been one of the top people in the top OUNB front organization in the U.S., the UCCA. Under Yushchenko, what was literally an Orwellian Ministry of Truth, that is, as in 1984 by George Orwell, the Institute for National Memory was set up, and former KGB archivists, now under the auspices of SBU, that was the new Ukrainian Intelligence Service, began systematically rewriting and revising Ukrainian history and stood it on its head. The top official in charge with doing that was a guy named Volodymyr Vyalichizin. Oh, no, wait a minute. It was somebody else. Can you pause? Volodymyr Vyatrovich. I may be mispronouncing that. And many of these other Ukrainian names. He was not only the head of this revisionist project under Yushchenko, but also the head of a top OUNB front organization in the Ukraine. And under Yushchenko and Ms. Yushchenko, the former Ms. Chumachenko, the history of the OUNB was completely stood on its head, whereas they had been ardent participants in massacres of various groups, Poles, Jews, and others, and had enthusiastically and effectively allied with the SS and the Einsatzgruppen and then Gestapo. All of that was turned on its head. They were made out to be anti-Nazis, and yet, in spite of the overt and venal fascist ideology of Svoboda, they are made out to be Democrats, with a small d, by the way. We have noted that in May of 2010, veterans of the 14th Waffen-SS Division honored Oleg Tiahnybok when he visited Canada, and about a year later, on April 28th of 2011, there was a celebration in Lvov, formerly Lemberg, and we're going to hear about that later, and the 14th Waffen-SS Division was openly feted by the citizens of that town. That demonstration was organized by Svoboda. And in this country, we have seen something not altogether unlike what was done in the Ukraine. We are seeing a fundamental perversion of political and historical reality, and the realities of organizations like Svoboda, which along with Pravi Sektor dominates the military and national security operations in the new Ukraine, and which also controls the judicial process and other key ministries, we are seeing them represented as relative moderates. And the coverage in the U.S., particularly by the New York Times, the Gray Lady, which has been, frankly, showing her CIA petticoats lately, that coverage has been Orwellian. We are seeing Newspeak come to pass, and a fundamental perversion of what is taking place in the Ukraine. That is very, very sad indeed, because the situation there is potentially explosive, literally, and we need to have accurate, with the citizens, that is, of this country, need to have accurate information, and we are not getting it. For example, the New York Times of March 11th of 2014 has the following article by Andrew E. Kramer, K-R-A-M-E-R, titled, Front and Center in Ukraine Race, a Leader of the Far Right. Now, this is about Mr. Dmitry Yarosh of the Pravi Sektor, even farther to the right than Svoboda. He is running for president. But what is really noteworthy here is how Svoboda, a venal, extreme fascist organization, Nazis, literally, as we looked at great length and in great detail in For the Record 781. By the way, excerpts of the Per Anders Rudling article chapter are in this description as well. But due to the limitations of time, we're going to be moving past those. Svoboda is fundamentally whitewashed in this presentation. They are presented as having moderated, which there is no indication that they have. And there are a couple of other historical lies. Note that after he had met with John McCain some weeks back, Oleg Tyanibok, the head of Svoboda, met with Secretary of State John Kerry this past Tuesday. That would have been March 11th. The article reads of Dmitry Yarosh, a top Ukrainian defense official and the head of Pravi Sektor. Mr. Yarosh, Y-A-R-O-S-H, has hinted at a role for his group in balancing the influence of a longtime player in Ukrainian politics, Yulia V. Tymoshenko, the former prime minister who emerged from prison after the fall of the old government with members of her political party, Fatherland, already holding the positions of acting president and prime minister. Before the protests, the Nationalist Party Svoboda had occupied the nationalist niche to the right of Ms. Tymoshenko, but Svoboda and Fatherland are now alive. Parenthetically, as we looked at in For the Record 779, they were allied all along. It's not that they are now allied. More very subtle lying here by the New York Times. The Svoboda Party, meanwhile, has moderated, and note this, and did not openly endorse the tactic of throwing firebombs when street fighting began in January. Note that Svoboda is portrayed as having moderated. There is no indication that they have done that, although public relations experts appear to be hard at work trying to get some of these people to shut their mouths and start mouthing some appropriate Western platitudes appropriate for the Western political palate. Svoboda is portrayed as having moderated, and one of the indications of that was that they didn't openly endorse the tactic of throwing firebombs during the recent street demonstrations. Presumably, if one advocates such a thing clandestinely, that constitutes moderation. Continuing, Svoboda was founded in 1991 under the name the Socialist Nationalist Party of Ukraine, with a symbol that resembled a swastika. Its leader, Oleg Tyanibok, met Secretary of State John Kerry on Tuesday. More interesting, subtle, but very significant distortion here by the New York Times. The Times of March 2nd, 2014, has an article by Andrew Higgins and Allison Smale, S-M-A-L-E, titled, "In Crimea's Phantom War, Armed Men Face Unseen Foe." And notice the very subtle propaganda here. Russian media, a potent weapon in the battle to demoralize and divide what remains of Ukrainian state authority in Crimea, has announced a string of defections, some true, some not, and kept up a drumbeat with accounts of how Ukraine has slipped into the hands of extremists, terrorists, and even Nazis. Well, that would be a very, this is me speaking here, that of course is basically what has happened to a large extent. There are some suits such as Mr. Yatsenyuk up front in this, but the people in Svoboda and Pravi Sektor are about as out there as you can get. One of the elected deputies to the Ukrainian parliament from Svoboda characterized Ukrainian-born actress Mila Kunis, who recently got engaged to her 70s show co-star Ashton Kutcher, as, quote, a dirty Jewess, unquote. That is representative of what Svoboda is all about. There's nothing moderate about them. They are Nazis. I mean, basically, they're not German Nazis, but they were allied with German Nazis, and they celebrate them, in particular their chief ideologist, Mr. Michael Schiessen. More subtle propaganda here. Again, from the New York Times of February 26th of 2014, another story by Andrew Higgins, this one co-authored with Stephen Lee Myers. As Putin orders drills in Crimea, protesters clash, shows regions divide, and it reads in part, "I don't want to live in a country run by fascists," said Sergei Ganko, G-A-E-N-K-O, a retired law enforcement official echoing a widespread view here that Mr. Yanukovych's ouster was engineered by the political descendants of militant Ukrainian nationalists who, during World War II, sometimes formed loose tactical alliances with Hitler's invading army. Crimea, he added, was illegally given to Ukraine, unquote, by Nikita Khrushchev, and he said it was time to, quote, correct an historic injustice. Like many Russians here, he scorned the new interim government as made up of Benderovsky, a derogatory Soviet term used to describe followers of Stefan Bandera, a wartime Ukrainian nationalist leader vilified by Moscow as a pro-Nazi traitor. What is so interesting here is the spin that the New York Times puts on this. Basically, what Genka was saying is true. It's a matter of public record. Please stretch out with the descriptions for the Record Program 779, 780, and in particular 781. Take a look at what these creatures are really all about. And yet, the whole thing is portrayed as Russian propaganda, formerly Soviet propaganda. Again, even Nazis, you know, lions and tigers and bears, oh my. If Sergei Lazarov, the Russian foreign minister, or Vladimir Putin said 2 plus 2 equals 4, the New York Times would spin that to, in a frequent theme sounded by Russian public pronouncements, Sergei Lazarov and Vladimir Putin have claimed that 2 plus 2 equals 4, a key feature of Russian mathematical propaganda. I mean, it is surreal at one level and Orwellian at another. More about the New York Times and how they have spun things. We talked about this in For the Record Program 779. From the New York Times of February 24th, an article by Peter Baker, and he's talking about pressure on Barack Obama to be more forceful and how Obama has reacted very differently to this Ukrainian crisis than the way George W. Bush reacted to the so-called Orange Revolution, which brought Mr. Yushchenko and his wife, the former Ekaterina Chumachenko, to power with results that we looked at last week. In the story, skipping down, quote, "The administration's Ukraine policy is emblematic of a broader problem with today's foreign policy. The absence of a strategic vision, disinterest in democracy promotion, and an unwillingness to lead," said Paula J. Dobryansky, an Undersecretary of State for George W. Bush. She also, by the way, was part of Ronald Reagan's National Security Council. Her father, Lev Dobryansky, was Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas, and Lev Dobryansky was also a key person with the UCCA, the top OUNB front organization in the U.S. One of the people who is on the New York Times editorial board, and I am perhaps being a little unfair in calling the subtitling this Schmemann über alles, a fellow named Serge Schmemann, last name S-C-H-M-E-M-A-N-N, is on the New York Times editorial board. He is their former Bonn correspondent, and since the Ukrainian crisis began, he has had a couple of op-ed pieces in the New York Times Sunday edition, sort of interpreting everything for us. I remember Serge Schmemann from a skewed and frankly sort of snide review that he wrote of Christopher Simpson's landmark book, Blowback, which we have used at great length, and For the Record program number, AFA program 37, among other programs. And I'm going to read this interview with this review, I should say, of Blowback by Christopher Simpson. This is from the New York Times of May 8th of 1988 by their Bonn correspondent. The Bonn, of course, was the capital of the former West Germany, Serge Schmemann. "Give us your tired, your poor, and your Nazi scientists," unquote. And he then goes on to comment about Christopher Simpson. "But Mr. Simpson argues further that the recruitment of East Europeans and other anti-communists by the CIA after the war served to keep Washington on a Cold War track to this day." Bear in mind, he was talking about 88. We still are. He talks of, quote, "the scars that secret emigre anti-communist programs have left on life in the United States, down to the survival of the liberationist cause," unquote, "in the Reagan administration's Cold War strategy," unquote. There are several problems here. More seriously, Mr. Simpson's logic has the effect of smearing anti-communism with the taint of Nazism. Liberationism may not be a uniquely Nazi idea, he writes, quote, but the fact remains that ideas and theories have histories just as nations do. The true origins of liberationism as a coherent philosophy lie in Nazi Germany and in the Nazis' political warfare campaign on the Eastern Front and nowhere else. Today, liberation activists, unquote, may have a reasonably sophisticated agenda, he continues, but, quote, the one position they cling to above all is an implacable paranoia toward the USSR that would permit no arms control treaties, no trade, and indeed no East-West cooperation of any type, only relentless preparation for war, unquote. That is a serious charge, and in the light of the real case histories of Nazi mass murderers, it is patently unfair. Mr. Simpson claims that something called the Captive Nations Movement, in which the CIA had a hand, hindered Presidents Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon in their search for détente with the Soviet Union. Even if it did, is that really a blowback from the recruitment of Nazis? Mr. Simpson likewise seems to make a fairly heady leap from argument to conclusion in describing how clandestine operations to roll back communism backfired in Eastern Europe. In the case of the Ukraine, he claims, instead of rallying to the new, quote, democratic, unquote, movement, there is every indication that many of the ordinary people of the Ukraine gave increased credence to the Soviet government's message that the U.S., too, was really Nazi at heart and capable of using any sort of deceit and violence to achieve its ends. Well, basically, Christopher Simpson was quite correct. This review was written on May 8th of 1988. As we stand now, more than a quarter of a century later, basically that same political inertia from those very same forces have really fundamentally distorted the reportage on what is going on in the Ukraine and indeed have fundamentally perverted historical reality there. I had wondered about Serge Schmemann's background. Again, he was the Bonn, Germany correspondent for the Times when he wrote that review back on 5/8/88. With the advent of the Internet, a little more about him from his Wikipedia.com article about Serge Schmemann. Born in France on April 12th of 1945, the son of Alexander Schmemann and Julia Orseguin. He moved to the United States as a child in 1951. He grew up speaking Russian at home, but he visited his ancestral homeland for the first time only in 1980. And of Alexander Schmemann, note that Serge Schmemann was born in France just before the end of World War II, April 12, 1945. Of his father, Alexander Schmemann, again from Wikipedia, Alexander Schmemann was born on September 13, 1921, in Tallinn, Estonia, into a family of Russian white emigres. His grandfather had been a senator and a member of the state council when his father was an officer of the Imperial Life Guards. When he was a child, his family moved to France, where he was educated in Russian schools and at a French lycée before becoming a student at the University of Paris from 1940 to 1945. What is interesting about this is the fact that Serge Schmemann's father was descended from white Russian emigres, and his father had actually been an Imperial Life Guard for the Tsar. His family moved to France, and he was educated, Alexander Schmemann, in Russian schools, and was a student at the University of Paris from 1940 to 1945. That, of course, was during World War II. The Nazis occupied Paris during that time. Now, we're going to very quickly introduce a couple of elements here. We will be exploring the world island concept as it applies to the Ukraine at greater length next week as one sees the events unfolding in the Ukraine. Never forget that 25% of all of the proven natural gas reserves in the world are in the Ukraine, and I suspect that has an awful lot to do with what is going on here. Middle East Online of March 13th, 2014 Turkey moves to protect Crimea's Tatar minority. Turkey, which has kept a low profile in the Ukraine crisis, is making moves to protect Crimea's ethnic Tatar minority as the region prepares for a referendum on joining Russia this week. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has pledged to support Crimea's Turkish-speaking Tatar minority, which Ankara fears could be sidelined in the March 16th vote on switching over to Kremlin rule. Turkey has never left Crimean Tatars alone and will never do so, he said after a phone call to Russian President Vladimir Putin earlier this month. Turkey's Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoglu vowed to protect the, quote, rights of our kinsmen, unquote, after meeting with Ukrainian officials and representatives of the Tatar community during an unscheduled visit to Kiev earlier this month. Long story made short, we will explore this in future programs, but neither Mr. Erdogan nor Mr. Davutoglu could be viewed as an advocate of human rights. Both are Islamist and also both are pan-Turkists, openly seeking to restore the glory, if not the actual territory, of the former Ottoman Empire. And inside, too, we're going to be talking about pan-Turkism and the outside Turks in the context of political and military warfare against the former Soviet Union and now potentially against Russia as well. New York Times story from March 14th of 2014 by Noah Snyder, S-N-E-I-D-E-R. Crimean Tatars on guard against joining Russia, reads in part. While the Tatars have a history of peaceful resistance, the potential for radicalization does exist. Tatar militants have fought alongside the opposition in Syria, and Hizb-ut-Tahrir, an Islamic group banned in several countries, including Russia, has 1,000 members in the Crimea, according to Fazil Amzayev, a spokesman for the group's local chapter. Whether Hizb-ut-Tahrir, which is both Islamist, affiliated loosely with the al-Qaeda milieu, also has links with the German NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party. It also has very strong roots in Turkey and has some sort of pan-Turkish leanings as well. Hizb-ut-Tahrir is also active in the United States. One of the things that we are going to be looking at inside, too, is the role of both Turkic-speaking minorities inside of the former Soviet Union and Ukrainian forces in pre-World War II political activism against the USSR, and then later the folding of many of those same types of elements into the Nazi armies and the actual combat against the former Soviet Union. Many of these same elements then coalesced after World War II in the form of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and the various Western intelligence agencies, including CIA and BND and MI6. We are going to be looking in particular at something called the Promethean League, or Prometheus Organization, or Promethée in France. That was a sort of a pre-Wackel-Wackel. It was based in Poland, received a lot of support from the Sikorsky government. It also, however, was supported very strongly by French intelligence and had a lot of French components. We're going to talk more about Promethée in Side 2. This, however, concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 782. All's Well That's Orwell, Part 2, The Ministry of Truth and the Ukrainian Crisis, Part 2, subtitled Shmeiman Uber Ares. This has been recorded on March 16th of 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.